Today, household financial stress before the storm. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, from the latest post covering finance and property news. Well, as I've been discussing recently, the Gulf War is going to engulf households in a world of pain, with higher prices, higher interest rates, and potentially a recession. So it is worth just taking stock, a bit of a benchmark really, of where households currently stand with regard to their finances. And to do that, I'm going to look at the latest from my modelling, which is to the end of March. Of course, just towards the end of March, interest rates were beginning to tick up and oil prices were moving higher. But as yet, the true impact has really not come through into the data. So I'm going to share some of my data, and this is an introduction to my analysis. I'll probably do a more detailed postcode level show later, but this is a top-down view. And to start, I want to look at just the data from the US. This is from Moody's and Equifax to show that subprime borrowers in the US are under significant financial stress. And you can see there that it's ticking up to levels that, well, were seen in 2014 and 2015. In Australia, households at the moment are not defaulting at any significant rate, but the cash flow pressures are definitely there. And so that's what I'm going to focus on today. And on the way into that, I thought that we should start by just looking at the latest data on home prices. Catelity released the latest data the other day, and this was quite a nice summary that Westpac Economics did. They showed that the index rose 0.6% in March, following gains of 0.5% in February and 0.6% in January and 0.4% in December. Annual growth on average over the year was 9.3%. But they say that the March update confirms that the changed interest rate outlook has translated into moderation in price growth and a sharper pullback in turnover. Another way of looking at it is looking at the movements of houses versus units on average above Australia, and you can see that the growth rates are definitely coming back. Looking in more detail, they said that Sydney and Melbourne dwellings have actually declined. Sydney prices declined a further 0.1% month over month in non-seasonally adjusted terms. And the fall was driven by a 0.3% decline in house prices, while unit prices actually rose 0.3%. And the annual growth rate has slowed to 4.8%, down from a recent peak of 6.6%. Melbourne prices recorded the worst result among the capitals, falling 0.2% over the month. And that was led by a 0.4% fall in house prices. Unit prices growth of 0.3% was insufficient to offset that weakness, and annual growth remained the slowest of the major capitals at 3.4% over the past year. But of course, the recent trends are pointing downward. Brisbane and Perth, well, there was movement on the positive side. Brisbane showed that price growth accelerated modestly, reaching 1.8% across the month, with both houses and units increasing 1.7% and 2% respectively. Annual growth lifted to 19%, the strongest outcome since July 2022. And in Perth, prices continue to rise strongly, increasing 2.5% over the month and 24% over the year, the strongest performance of any capital city. Both houses and units recorded robust gains of 2.5% over the month and 2.9% over the month, respectively. In Adelaide, prices rose 1.2%, matching the pace of the previous 2 months. The annual growth was 11.4%. And they also remained firm in Hobart, up 0.8% and up 7.8% over the year. The story in the smaller capitals was a little bit different. If mixed, price growth accelerated sharply in Darwin, up 1.6%. And up 19.7% over the year. And Canberra was up 0.4% and up 6.1% over the year. Now, here's a quick summary that shows how the rate cuts and rate hikes overlaid. on the movements. Compare Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Hobart, Canberra, and regional areas. And here is a summary that shows just how different the spread is between what's happening in Sydney and Melbourne with falls in March compared with rises elsewhere, and also highlight the turnover down 9.1% in March, which I think is a quite significant thing. And they summarise it by saying that turnover fell sharply in March, with preliminary estimates pointing to a quarterly decline of around 9.1%, reflecting the impact of recent policy rate hikes on buyer sentiment. The decline was concentrated in Greater Sydney and Melbourne, although all capital cities recorded falls on a three-month basis. Annual growth in turnover has now slipped to down 0.7% over the year. Despite the weakness, they say sales continue to outpace new listings by a wide margin, indicating that supply conditions remain tight. And then they go on to discuss auction clearance rates. Of course, there were very few auctions over the long weekend, and the auction clearance rates remained below long-term averages in Sydney, and more materially fell below average in Melbourne. While both markets saw clearance rates touch recent lows during March, a modest recovery was evident towards the end of the month. And overall, the results remain consistent with a pronounced slowing in the markets. And they highlight, of course, that clearance rates really are only meaningful in Sydney and Melbourne. Now, here's another way of representing the same information. And once again, it does highlight the dispersion between Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, and Brisbane. And as I mentioned the other day, the recent statement of financial stability from the Reserve Bank highlighted the fact that real disposable income per capita has been rising, and claims on household income are still pretty extended, although they say nothing to see here. Well, I've got a different view, and I highlight this one again. If you look at housing affordability, this is based on CBA analysis, on dual full-time average incomes to a household, buying a medium-priced property shows that the affordability is pretty shot. And of course, it's going to get a lot worse with interest rates rising. And there's a gap, of course, between actual median prices and capacity to pay. It's going to get worse again. Now, turning to my analysis, I used my core market model. I get survey data rolling all in all the time. The latest data to the end of March. And it comprises 52,000 households, which is about a 0.5% sample across Australia. And we can slice and dice the data lots of different ways. And we can also form a view as to what may happen based on some scenarios. And we'll talk about those scenarios because, of course, the scenarios are now looking significantly less positive, particularly with regard to energy and interest rates. We can take the mortgage stress data, the price trajectory history data, the buying and selling intentions, the migration data, the economic data like CPI, wages and employment. All it goes into the coal market model, plus the scenarios, and we can look at it at a postcode level, rather than a region, state, and all Australia level, and also form some views about where things may go. And as in passing, let me just mention that we do still provide our one-to-one service. This is a chance to have a specific individual conversation with me about a particular suburb. I can't give financial advice, but I can look at the data for a particular postcode or suburb and look at the underlying trends. And we can also form a view of what may happen ahead based on the scenarios. It's a conversation, often about an hour via Zoom or phone. And there is a charge involved simply because it's a lot of work to put it together. If you're interested, you can contact me via the blog. Space is limited. Booking 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment, unless there's a really urgent need. And I encourage you to reach out if you think I can help. So let's now just look at the results from the survey. And just to be clear, when I talk about financial stress, I have a very particular way of doing it because, of course, you can define stress almost any way you want. And as I say, when there are many different definitions out there, from 30% of income or taxable income through to underlying metrics, we define stress in cash flow terms, money in, money out. Very important now because, of course, with higher inflation, cash flow pressures will continue to grow. So I argue that if households have more outgoings, and I exclude one-off discretionary items like, for example, the annual holiday and income, we define them as stress. They have a mortgage, they're in mortgage stress. If renting, they're in rental stress. Investors can have cash flow pressures too, so we look for those as stressed investors. And we can look at the data to estimate the total financial stress of a particular postcode. And that means we can look at it both in percentage terms, number of households, and percentage of households in financial stress. Now, the number, the count, to my mind, is a better indicator of what's really going on. So we tend to focus on the count. The rule of big numbers applies. And by the way, this chart from the RBA some years ago summarizes very nicely the problem with financial stress. It starts mild with budget pressures, but it can morph into missing payments or indeed insolvency. And insolvency, which is at the severe end of financial stress, can follow, but that journey can take 3 to 5 years. Now, I measure stress on my metric at the mild end, the budget pressures end, but it is a precursor potentially to missing payments and insolvency. It's worth also highlighting, of course, that the banks continue to support people in financial pressure. They extend and pretend by offering longer mortgage terms or indeed going interest only. And they're managing to keep the actual insolvency rate, to delinquency rate, quite low. Also, of course, because house prices have risen quite strongly over recent years, people who are in difficulty can sell and get out and not lose their shirt, repay the bank. So that never appears as a delinquency or default. The question, of course, will be whether ahead that is going to continue or whether we start to see insolvencies rise, as we saw in that slide from the US. So, summarizing the data to the end of March 2026, we're going to start by looking at rental stress. And I'm afraid that rental stress is still pretty painful. 3/4 of people in the rental sector have cash flow pressures. And you can compare that with much smaller numbers in the early 2000s. It went up after COVID, but never came down and has stayed on a high plateau. Mortgage stress, a bit the same, really. Just around 50%, 49.7% actually, of households with mortgages have cash flow pressures. That went up from 32.9% pre-COVID and never came down again. And that's a combination of the larger mortgages that people have, the fact that real income growth is very static, and of course inflation has been very strong. The RBA also reports debt to income ratios, and they continue to show it tracking down slightly, but remember that that actually includes all households, whether they have mortgages or not. And so the true number is quite a lot higher. We are still seeing a lot of debt to income ratios of 6, 7, 8, and 9 times. And as I showed earlier on, housing affordability is pretty shot. Now, if we look at the March data, this is the summary information. You can see there that overall stress levels for mortgages sitting at 49.7%. And you can see that it does vary by state. Mortgage stress is highest at 53.9% in Tasmania and 53.4% in Victoria. It's 51.1% in New South Wales. It's a little bit lower, for example, in the ACT. It's just 40%. Looking at rental stress at 75.1%, rental stress is sitting quite high in the ACT, in New South Wales, more than 80%. It's 77% in Tasmania, 75% in Victoria, and 71% in Western Australia, quite a lot lower in the NT. Looking at the investor stress, you can see there it's sitting about 18%, so not dramatically high, but I do note that 20% of property investors in New South Wales have cash flow pressures compared with 17% in Victoria. And if we look at overall financial stress at 47.8%, that translates, by the way, to more than 4.76 million households out of the pretty much 10 million households we have. You can see that financial stress is sitting highest in New South Wales at 51.3%. That's more than 1.6 million households there. In Victoria, at 47.9%, there is 1.22 million households in financial stress. And that compares with Western Australia at 46.1%, with just 477,000 households. In Queensland, at 46%, 925,000 households in financial stress. And just coming back specifically to mortgage stress, the 49.7% equates to 1.8 million households across the country with financial pressures and a mortgage. And rental stress at 75.1% means that more than 2.3 million households in the rental sector have cash flow pressures. Now, these are big numbers, but of course it means that not everybody is equally impacted. There are still people who are paying their mortgages fine. There are still people paying their rents fine. And of course, there are some people who own their property outright and they're doing okay at the moment. Whether that will change, of course, will be determined by how high petrol prices go, how high inflation goes, and what the energy story becomes in Australia later. Now, we can look at the data also another way, and this is looking at the information based on our cohorts or segments. And you can see there that the mortgage stress lurks most strongly among young growing families. That includes a lot of first-time buyers, 88.4%. That's 293,000 households, young growing families with mortgage stress. Looking at mortgage stress again, if we go to the battling urban segment, 80% have mortgage stress. That's 137,000. But the biggest cohort is actually the disadvantaged fringe, those people in the outer suburbs, those people on those new estates with home loan packages at 74.6%. That's more than 503,000 households in difficulty. Turning to rental stress, 75%, 2.33 million, as I said earlier on. And you can see there that rental stress is widely represented. Suburban mainstream, 75.9%. The mature stables, families at 303,000. And the multicultural establishment at 194,000. Now, they include a lot of first-generation migrants, the new migrants to Australia, and they represent 84.2% of those households. So a lot of people are coming into Australia as new migrants, going to the rental sector and getting into financial difficulty quite quickly. But the highlight here is that it's spread quite widely. 8% of young growing families, more than 181,000, also have rental stress. Looking at stressed investors, well, no surprise to see that it's the exclusive professionals and the young affluents who have the bulk of property investments who are in difficulty. But again, it's widely spread. And the aggregate financial stress data shows 47.8% in financial stress. And you can see there that young growing families at 67.7% are at the top of the list. The battling urban at 59.9%. And then 55.5% the multicultural establishment, the first generation Australians, 51% the young affluents, 54% the disadvantaged fringe, and 52.5% exclusive professionals. So the point here is all cohorts are actually experiencing some degrees of financial stress. Now, I'm just going to briefly touch on the analysis at a postcode level. And you can see there that Liverpool, Campbelltown in New South Wales, 2170 and 2560 at the top of the list, then Roxburgh Park in Victoria, Wanneroo in Western Australia, Toowoomba in Queensland, Narrewarren in Victoria, Pakenham in Victoria, Berwick and Harkaway in Victoria, Tarnett in Victoria. Of course, they are all new growth suburbs. Then we have regional areas like Ballarat, back to Riverstone in New South Wales, Camden, New South Wales, and Pine Mountain in Queensland. And you can see there that the percentage of households in mortgage stress vary. In some, it's close to 100%. Elsewhere, not so high. I just want to highlight these numbers are big. So in Liverpool, 13,400. In Campbelltown, 12,140. And those numbers are painfully high. The risk of default is also worth looking at. So Cranbourne in Victoria has the highest risk of default in the next 12 months. Mandurah in Western Australia, that was from the previous peak and drop cycle. Roxburgh Park in Victoria, Tarnett in Victoria, Bundaberg in Queensland, Armidale in Western Australia, Success in Western Australia, Yatala in Queensland, Wanneroo in Western Australia. Do you want to highlight Western Australia is still reaping the whirlwind from the previous bubble and collapse of prices. So it does take time for this to work through. Looking at rental stress, centre of Melbourne in Victoria has the prize for the highest count at 23,516 households at 85% of those renting. Then we go to Liverpool in New South Wales, 2170, followed by Toowoomba in Queensland, Southport in Queensland, Zetland in New South Wales, Mount Druitt in New South Wales, Campbelltown in New South Wales, Ipswich in Queensland, Westmead in New South Wales, Bundaberg in Queensland, Tarnett in Victoria, Blacktail in New South Wales, and Coomera in Queensland. And then we look at the stressed investors, and you can see there that Gosford, Narromburn in New South Wales, Blacktown in New South Wales, Westmead in New South Wales are at the top there. We are seeing more property investors in New South Wales struggling with cash flow, but we're also seeing similar problems in Queensland, particularly Bundaberg, Beaumont Hills in New South Wales, Mandurah in Western Australia, Toowoomba in Queensland, Gundaroo in New South Wales, Craignish in Queensland, Hornsby in New South Wales, Strathfield in New South Wales, and Turvey Park in New South Wales. So it's worth highlighting that the pressure for investors in New South Wales is building, and it's building quite fast. And then finally, financial stress. So this is the aggregate measure. Liverpool, postcode 2170, with 72.7% of households in difficulty. That's more than 39,000 households in the area. Toowoomba, with more than 48,000 households, is second, and just over half of households in that area are in difficulty. Campbelltown, New South Wales, 2560, at 74.7%, more than 30,000. Roxburgh Park in Victoria, Tarnet in Victoria, Ballarat, Victoria, Derwent in Victoria, Melbourne in Victoria, Cranbourne in Victoria, all following. Those include high growth suburbs. And we can go down the list to Blacktown in New South Wales, Ipswich in Queensland, Mount Druitt in New South Wales, Pakenham in Victoria, Wanneroo in Western Australia, Bundaberg in Queensland. Next, I'm going to talk briefly about our scenarios, because I think our scenarios become ever more important now. These scenarios are ways of exploring different futures and to consider the consequences. They're not forecasts, but it does show you some of the sensitivities we've got. None of the scenarios may well be right. Things change. And we use that framework from our core market model. And when they look at outcomes ahead, the scenarios run from effectively now. So let's look at the three scenarios. The first is still the Goldilocks zone. Let's assume rates don't move up from 4.1% until the middle of 2027. Then they ease at that point. We see inflation still above target until 2027. Strong migration. We still get first-time buyer booms. We don't get a recession in Australia. And we get wages rising faster than inflation. Some would call that the Goldilocks zone. I'd call it the fairy tale zone, I think, from what I'm seeing at the moment. The second is the softer landing. So we see rate rises to 4.35%, but no higher. The inflation eases in line with what the RBA was expecting, although I think it's now unlikely. Wages rise slower than inflation. We get a recession in Australia and we get migration slowing. In the worst case scenario, the nightmare scenario, we see rates rising from 4.1% as inflation steps up. Of course, the markets are now talking about cash rates of 4.6% plus. We see a rising unemployment. We see stalling wages growth. And whilst there are rate cuts later, it doesn't really help. Migration drops significantly and we get stagflation. So those are the three. And if we take that information and then apply it at an aggregate level, you can see that the average house prices across Australia still, in the best case scenario, have some upside. But the base case is a significant fall, over 10% across 3 years. The worst case, a fall of around 30% over 3 years, and units following on with perhaps slightly smaller falls. And we can go into slightly more detail. The ACT, for example, again, not seeing a huge amount of momentum based on my modelling over the next 12 months on the best case scenario, but falls certainly possible on the other two scenarios. And once again, units not quite so dramatic in terms of falls. If we look at New South Wales, yeah, there is still some scenarios on the upside on the best case scenario, but the base case is a fall of 12% over 3 years and the worst case, a fall of 32%. Units following on. In the Northern Territory, still some potential upside, but I have to say it's becoming a little bit more problematic. And of course, this is a very small data set, so there is some variability here, but I still see some downside scenarios coming through. And the same for units too. Looking at Queensland, the best case scenario, a rise of 7.8% over 3 years. The base case, a fall of 7.3% over 3 years. And the worst case, a fall of 27% over 3 years. And units following on. Looking at South Australia, growth in the best case scenario, 9% over 3 years. Base case down 6.1% over 3 years, and the worst case down 26.1%. And looking at units, pretty much following along. In Tasmania, well, I can't see a huge amount of growth ahead, even in the best case scenario. Base case, more of a fall, and the worst case, a more significant fall. And units following on. And Victorian prices, well, in the best case scenario, maybe a couple of percent rise over 3 years, but the base case, a fall down 13%, and the worst case, a fall of 33%. Units following on. Finally, if we look at Western Australia, you can see there that there is still a rise of 8.2% over 3 years in the best case. Base case, a fall of 7%, and the worst case, a fall of 27% over 3 years, and units following on. And let me just make the point that if you do a fundamental calculation based on incomes and people's capacity to pay, house prices are still, on average, 40% over where they should be. Now, whether they'll come back to that depends on what government policy is. So, for example, if the government says, no, we can't allow house prices to fall, and they throw money at it, they allow people to tap into superannuation, they give people Home Builder 2 or Save Your Mortgage 1, I don't know, whatever initiative, well, they could stop house prices falling even under the adverse conditions with high energy prices and maybe even lack of supply and high inflation. But of course, there is a cost to that. The cost is on the never never. It puts essentially the government debt even higher. We saw that. It potentially could be inflationary, which is a problem. Remember, inflation, of course, is well above target at the moment. And so the RBA will probably need to react by lifting rates rather than dropping rates. So there is no zero-sum game here. Somebody's going to pay. It's a question of who pays. And I also want to make the point that we have, at some point, to bite the bullet and recognize that the house price trajectory of the last 20 years is unsustainable and has to, at one point or another, adjust. Well, maybe this is a silver lining to the current crisis. Is this the opportunity to allow prices to adjust and to bring more affordable housing back into vogue? And remember, housing should be about providing somewhere to live rather than being a financial investment vehicle. And I do note the government is still talking potentially about dialing back CGT and negative gearing in May. We'll see whether they do. So what does this all mean? Well, what it means is that the housing market is going to go through a very torrid time. I wouldn't be surprised to see more difficulty in terms of selling property, prices beginning to slide further, interest rates rising, inflation rising. All of the scenarios are dealing with some of these, well, probably quite immediate impacts now. How high interest rates go, difficult to say. The RBA is not yet telling us very much, although markets are being quite firm about it, 4.6% or more. Now, as I bring these threads together and come to the end of the show, what are the implications? Well, I think the first thing to say is there's huge amounts of uncertainty. Nobody quite knows what is going to happen. Uncertainty creates its own difficulty in terms of trying to make property purchase or sale decisions. I think more people will just hang loose and see what happens. And the third point to make is, I'm not sure that we can assume the government is automatically going to click its fingers and solve the problem again. It could be that they have to let things just fester. So where does that take us? Well, what it means is that as individual households, whether you're in the rental sector or in the property owning sector, it becomes ever more important to understand your own finances and to be familiar with where the money's coming from and where is it going. How much am I earning? How much am I spending? One of the things I always say to people is draw up a cash flow. Understand where the money is coming in from. Look at what you're spending money on and consider whether you're spending it wisely and on the things that are really important. Quite often, of course, you've got things like subscriptions that you took out some time ago and forgot about. Well, get rid of those. And make sure that you've got the best possible value on things like insurance and even interest rates on both deposits and on mortgages. I'll also make the point that if you do have financial pressure, there are people who can help. And it's very important to go to the right source for help. The one I recommend is the National Debt Helpline, 1-800-007-007. This, of course, is government-backed It's financial counselors who really can deal with your situation and help with debt problems, debt solutions, and complex situations. And I have to tell you that we know they're very busy, but nevertheless, it can make a difference. This is from their data recently that said that 74% avoided legal action when financial counseling was at work. 69% are more positive about the future. 66% resolve their financial difficulties. 63% improve their mental well-being. 53% avoid bankruptcy. And 45% improve their physical health. The point there is that financial pressure can lead to relationship breakdown and health breakdown. So it's important to get the right help. I also make the point, of course, that banks have an obligation to help in terms of financial hardship. The trouble is that some of the suggestions that they will make, extending the mortgage term or going interest only, may help the bank, but doesn't always help the particular household. So treat it with caution, and just assuming you can refinance to fix the problem may be a bit limited. The other point I'd make is that people tend to grasp additional loans when they've got financial pressure, be it buy now, pay later, be it payday loans or some other mechanism. The trouble is that more debt can actually create more pressure. Truth is, of course, that if you are under financial pressure, then the sooner you pay off the high interest rate debt, the better, because, of course, high interest rates cost you more. Now, there's another tool that I always mention in these shows, and that's the AFCAS Statement of Financial Position. This is a really useful tool that you can go and get from AFCAS website. It allows you to put in your household income, living expenses, the property details, other assets, the debts, and a proposal, if you have it, to deal with it. And this is a really powerful tool that you can take and use with a financial advisor or indeed talk to your bank. So this is a very useful tool that AFCAS put up. I recommend it. Now, if you're interested in more detailed information about what we do and particularly the analysis that we do at a postcode level, you can actually sign up for our postcode level analysis. We do this every month. There is a charge. It's $50 plus GST, but that gives you access to more than 2,000 postcode data points. And we update it every month, and we send this information out towards the middle of the month. So we'll be sending it out in the next couple of weeks. Finally, I'll just mention that we have a blog, the digitalfinanceanalytics.com blog, which you can use to contact us. There's a little help button there, or indeed check out our research and reports. So here we are at the end of the show. And just to summarize, yes, households are coming into this precarious situation with high levels of debt, high levels of financial pressure, and significant cash flow pressures. Not everybody, but quite a few. Ahead, my expectation is these pressures are going to build. And so it becomes ever more important for households to grasp the nettle and to start thinking about how to sandbag their finances. If you want more about that, check out my recent show with Tony LeCantro from this last week, where we talked about what you do to sandbag your finances. There are things that you can do. But I do fear that we are going to see these stress levels continue to rise in the months ahead, assuming that the conflict continues, assuming interest rates go up and oil prices, or indeed scarcity of oil, may well drive the economy into the ground. So in summary, I think what we've looked at is a bit of a baseline, and I'll be comparing where we are now with what happens in the months ahead. Separately, I'll probably do a more detailed show looking at individual postcodes. And if you're interested in a particular postcode that you'd like me to cover, if you put it in the comments below, I'll try and make sure that I do cover it in one of those shows. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. My thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.